Well, this morning we're wrapping up our Faith Foundation series, which we've gone through the whole summer, just looking at the foundational things of faith. And many of you have commented to us how you have appreciated these, and it's kind of anchored you in the cultural waters that just seem to continue to rise. And it's so true. I do feel like it's just kind of been an anchor that's just kind of set down in and can help us, because the waters are going to keep rising. And things are going to keep going against the gospel, and we need to be deeply rooted and grounded. Today we come to the end of that, which appropriately would be eternity, talking about eternity and what happens in that. And it's interesting that that's a hard concept for us to understand, because for us who live in the concept of time, talking about eternity is just a whole nother ballgame of what it means. It's hard to just kind of get our minds wrapped around it. In fact, there's a whole book that's written about this that kind of contrasts time and eternity, and it's the book of Ecclesiastes. And many people think that it's Solomon who wrote that, and I think that's probably a good guess. But Solomon, in that, he continually repeats the term living under the sun. So he refers to the fact that our life now, our life in time, is living under the sun. And it's interesting that it's repeated like 38 different times in it. And in the beginning of the book, he says, Havel, 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 all is Havel. Now, Havel is the Hebrew word that gets translated in English, meaningless or vanity. Perhaps in your translation, whichever one you use, you've seen more of the meaningless, meaningless, it's all meaningless, or vanity of vanity, it's all vanity. Those kind of get a concept of what it means, but it's so much bigger than that. Really, the actual word means smoke or vapor. So really what he's saying, it's like vapor, it's vapor. It's all vapor. It's like what James talks about in James 4 when he says, you don't even know what's going to happen tomorrow. Your life is but a mist, for it appears for a little while and then it vanishes. That's kind of the flavor that Solomon is using here. And when he talks about that, it's because when he's talking about life and living under the sun and all that goes on with that, I think there's a couple things he's wanting to do here. One, the whole gist of the book is the fact that we wouldn't put our hooks into this life, that because it is a vapor, we wouldn't try to live for it all now. And I think also he's just talking about the fact that there is a paradox in life. He says anytime you try to pursue something and something that you want in this life and try to give it more traction than it is supposed to have, you'll get it and it just seems to blow away. And he says it's like smoke. Smoke, smoke. He says it's all smoke. It's a realistic book, just basically saying don't anchor here now. But I think we all understand that, and you don't even need to be a believer to understand that, because in Ecclesiastes 3:11, he says this, he has put eternity into man's heart. He's put eternity in the hearts of men. In other words, he's given us a picture and an understanding. Ben referred to this last week when he talked about the fact that our bodies are groaning and the creation is groaning to be made new. That's why we just get so disappointed in this life and when unmet expectations or things that don't happen according to the way that we think they would. And it just is, it's frustrating, and it's us groaning. And there's two things you can do with those groanings. One, you can suppress it and go, well, just keep trying. Keep trying to make this life all there is. Keep trying to make this life all there is. Or you can embrace it. And by embracing it just means enjoy that which he has given in the beauty of what he's given, but don't fall in love with it. Don't fall in love with the creation as opposed to the creator. Don't make the creation your treasure. Keep the creator your treasure. And make no mistake about it. I mean, this is why C.S. Lewis really wrote, if you find a desire in yourself which nothing else can satisfy, perhaps you were made for another world. And that's exactly what he's getting at. He's going, when we go through this life and we try to hook our lives into things here to try to make them, give them more traction and do more than they were ever intended to do, then we end up in disappointment. But make no mistake about it, it's knowing that we are on this trajectory towards a road towards eternity where things will be fulfilled, righteousness will be fulfilled, peace and love and joy will be there. It's the only thing that makes this life make sense. And God has given us enough. He's given us enough of a picture to know so that we can really begin to see what is out there. And so this morning, this is what I want to do. I want to wrap our minds around this a little bit. And so I have with me this chair. We're going to consider this the throne of God. Now, I realize this is less than ominous, so work with me here. But this is his throne. This is the throne of God, and as we come through life, we're coming to that throne. We're on this side. We're on this side living under the sun, and we're coming up to this. Everything beyond this is eternity. Everything beyond it is eternity, into what comes next. On this life, under the sun, time is marching on. We're marching on towards a fulfillment. Nobody can skirt this. All lives, Christian or non-Christian, they're all coming to this throne. All roads lead will directly to here. You will not bypass. You will not get a get out of jail free card. You know, we are coming to this point. Everyone will. We're going to come to the throne, and it is at that throne. And this is really what Catherine read this morning when she read out of Matthew 25. There are many different passages on it. But when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne. And before him will be gathered all the nations. And he will separate people one from another. It is at this point where words and thoughts and actions are all revealed. Every thought you've ever had, every word you've ever spoken, every action you've ever taken is revealed right here. And it's made very clear in the scriptures that he says that those who are on his right, they go into eternity and they get to be with him in heaven. He says, but those who do not know Christ get to this point and they're actually judged by their works. And we all know, hopefully by now, as you've gone through this foundation series, that there's nothing in us that's going to make us worthy to be able to be into heaven. And so if you're relying upon your own works and your own religiosity, whatever it is to get there, it ain't going to work. And it says, he goes, go to my left. He says, this is eternity, and it is called hell. It is without Christ. You know, I kind of find it ironic. On 15th year anniversary, and I'm speaking on hell. It's been a nice run. this is the essence, and this is where we're coming to. I mean, and now just a couple of side notes on this. Annihilation isn't an option. Many try to soften it and go, well, it isn't eternity. It's just you're annihilated. You just cease to exist. You never get that in the scriptures. We were made to live for eternity. That's how God has wired us. And we will live forever. It's just a matter of where. And Christ wants us as believers to understand this point, to not skirt this, to not live as though this isn't coming to this, to live as though your life isn't going to come to this point. He wants you to know that you come to this point for a couple reasons as a believer. One, to keep you from sin. I mean, there's a sense in which you go, you know what? This is going to one day be revealed. I am not going to go down this road. And I think it also comforts those who are in adversity. Those who are suffering are comforted by this because they know when they get to this point and they come to it, everything's going to be made right. Everything is going to be made just. So it gives them hope now, life under the sun. And so this morning, I want to talk about both of these sides. And I'll start with the one we like best. First, for believers and the reality of heaven. You know, as we stand here before Christ, we know that there is nothing in ourselves that's going to be able to go there. If there's even an inkling in us that says, if I just do this and I've done this and I've done this, we've missed the gospel. Because the gospel tells us that we are more sinful than we could ever dare imagine, but we are more loved than we could ever dare hope. And so when we come to this point, we know, God, I bring nothing. Absolutely nothing. The only thing that separates me from going on your right or your left is Jesus. And Jesus is the one. I claim Jesus. It's his righteousness. We've talked about it. He's given me his righteousness. He went to the cross for me, so I take him. And we get glimpses of what that will look like. You know, Mercy Me made a song, created a song back at the turn of the century. It's hard to believe that it's been that long ago. But it's I Can Only Imagine. And in those words, a few of the words, I can only imagine what it will be like when I walk by your side. I can only imagine what my eyes would see when your face is before me. Surrounded by your glory, what will my heart fill? Will I dance for you, Jesus, or in awe of you be still? Will I stand in your presence, or will I fall on my knees? Will I sing hallelujah, or will I even be able to speak at all? I can only imagine. You know, what I find what's interesting is that the biblical writers, while they give us a sense of what this is going to be like, and there's a lot of theology on heaven, but we don't know it all. We don't know when it's going to happen. We don't know the full scope. We get some imagery of it, and the imagery is just to help us to know it's going to be better than anything you could ever imagine. It's not just going to be on the clouds and singing and all this kind of stuff. I mean, we're going to be living for eternity with him, doing things, working, doing the things that he created us to do. And it's going to be this unbelievable thing. But what's interesting is that most of the writers go, okay, so that's what's going to be. So let's back up then and let's talk about what does it mean then to live in light of that? How do you live under the sun knowing that that's what's coming? How should that shape how we are here? Because this is where we are here now, right? I mean, we haven't come to this point yet. So we are here. We're still on our way to that throne. How do we live now? Peter speaks of this. Notice Peter says, the day of the Lord will come like a thief, when the heavens will pass away with a roar, and the heavenly bodies will be burned up and dissolved, and the earth and the works that are done on it will be exposed. I mean, imagine all is gone. Your house, gone. Your treasures, gone. Everything that we put so much investment in, gone. It's no longer there. And then he goes on, since all these things are thus to be dissolved, he asks the question, what sort of people ought you to be? In lives of holiness and godliness, waiting and hastening the coming of the day of the Lord. In other words, Peter is saying, look, in light of what's coming, in light of what we know is happening, how do we live in light of eternity now? And so for Peter, this wasn't just some abstract concept, something that was just kind of out there. He says, no, this has practical ramifications for how I live my life now, for the decisions I make, for how I treat people, how I view people, how I interact with others. It all goes back and it changes how we live. Go back to Matthew 25 when it talks about the sheep and the believers in Christ. And notice he says, come to me, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you. Now what's interesting about that is notice how that mirrors Jesus' first sermon on earth, his Beatitudes. His Sermon on the Mount, and his first blessed. Remember, he goes, blessed are those, blessed are those, blessed are those. What's the first one? Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. So at the end of time, he says, come to you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom. Then you go back to the Sermon on the Mount, he says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And I think this gives us some insight of what God is doing now in us to get us ready for this point. He says, blessed are the poor in spirit. So what does that mean? Well, we talked about this with a bunch of friends earlier this week, and we were talking about it, and I think my best guess at this is that this is, means those who come to Christ and have absolutely nothing. When we talk about poverty, it's hard for us to relate to that, for most of us. Poverty, having nothing, it's hard for us to relate to that. But when you talk about having nothing spiritually, poverty of spirit, poor in spirit, meaning I bring nothing spiritually to the table, and that's what God wants. He wants us to become poor in spirit, not someone who goes, man, I bring a lot to the table. God, it's so good I'm on your team. I've done this and this and this and this and done all these things. That's exact opposite of poor in spirit. Poor in spirit is when we come and go, God, I got nothing. I realize that even on my best day, it is woefully short. I understand that. And so what we find is that this is God's really agenda for us, is to make us completely dependent upon him. And so poverty spirit then means we bring nothing. And what's interesting is when you look in the scriptures, you see this. Go back to even before sin came into the world. And Adam was to name all the animals. And he realized he had a need. And he was alone. And he couldn't do anything about it. Now God could have just said, hey, animals, see the animals? Boom, here's Eve. But what did he do? He created him to turn to God and go, what? I got nothing. I have nothing. And I'm completely dependent upon you. And God goes, okay, go to sleep. Now watch what I'll do. You know, and he gives him Eve. How about fast forward? Go to Gideon. Gideon's all arrogant about how he can go into the battle and what he's going to do, and God just keeps reducing his men down to a 500-1 odds. Why? Because what did Gideon have to do then? God, if you don't come through, if you don't do this, then I got nothing. I don't have anything. How about when he fed the 5,000? Hey, let's feed them lunch. What do we got? Some bread, some fish. Okay, go feed them. We can't do that if you don't do something. How's that going to happen? And what does it do? It creates dependence. And so in our life, God is continually bringing things in our life, hard sometimes, things that cause us to go, God, I got nothing. I'm utterly dependent upon you. I like what J.D. Greer says. He says, if dependence is our goal, then weakness is our friend. I think this is why Paul would say, look, I exalt in my weaknesses because when I'm weak, I'm what? Strong. He says, because the less of me and the more of you is great. The more of me and the less of you, that isn't going to work. That's being rich in spirit. You know, and we struggle with this, don't we? I would much rather it say those who are middle class in spirit. Those are, you know, on the upper echelon in spirit. No, it's those who are poor in spirit. Those who bring absolutely nothing. So we become poor in spirit. We become like Christ. We become dependent on him. And when we come to the throne, it's very easy for us to go, I got nothing but Jesus. Come to me, those who are blessed by my Father, and enter in to the kingdom. And blessed you will be. Okay, that's the good side, right? But what about this one? This is the hard one to swallow, isn't it? Calls them goats. I don't know why. I mean, I've been on a ranch, and those little kid goats are cute. You know, but he calls them goats. Depart from me, you who are cursed, into eternal fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. Cursed, eternal fire. I mean, I don't know about you, but I don't like that. That does not sound appealing at all. Sounds horrible. But it didn't stop there. Revelation 20:10, and the devil that had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur where the beast and the false prophet were, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. Let me just say, these verses are not meant to make us comfortable. These are reality verses. Okay? Revelation 20:15, and if anyone's name is not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. And when you look at the other biblical descriptions of this, it's unquenchable fire. There's weeping and gnashing of teeth. There's utter darkness. There's anguish. There's eternal punishment. All of those things, which I just go, whoa, wait a minute. And many people wrestle with the existence of hell. Many people do. I mean, I don't like it either. And I wrestle with it. I'm like, wow. Okay, and some would say it's divine overreach. God's just had a bad day. He's going to cast people he doesn't like into some outward darkness forever. Or some people would say, well, the punishment far outweighs the crime. Like it's a misdemeanor and they're getting life. And there's popular theologians, you know, what's interesting, I find, you know, that we don't have a problem telling someone to go to H-E double toothpick, but we have a problem when God does. We don't have a problem doing it in our own sinful nature and warped sense of justice, but when God in perfect justice and holiness says this is the end, we go, well, wait a minute. That's just not just. There's a pastor, a famous pastor, Rob Bell of a megachurch up at Mars Hill in Michigan, and he wrote a book called Love Wins. And let me just show you, this is kind of this theology that has come out, and it tries to diminish this hell. Here's what he says. Telling a story about God who inflicts unrelenting punishment on people because they didn't do or say or believe the correct things in a brief window of time called life isn't a very good story. And I would agree, it's not a good story. But he goes on, the belief that untold masses of people suffering forever doesn't bring God glory. Restoration brings God glory. Eternal torment doesn't. Reconciliation brings God glory. Endless anguish doesn't. Renewal and return cause God's greatness to shine through the universe. Never-ending punishment doesn't. Now that sounds really good, doesn't it? But just as we read the word this morning, we said, this is the word of the Lord. We could read that and go, this is the word of men. Now, what would Paul say? Here's what Paul says in Romans 9. What if God, choosing to show his wrath and make his power known, bore with great patience the object of his wrath, prepared for destruction? What if he did this to make the riches of his glory known to the object of his mercy, whom he prepared in advance for glory, even us, whom he also called not only from the Jews, but also from the Gentiles. This is the word of the Lord. Now, I don't like it, but there's a lot of things in Scripture I don't like. But it doesn't mean I can turn it to my liking to try to soften it, to go, well, I got to make it more palatable. I got to make it something that fits my narrative. Something that fits my emotional makeup. I have to make it that way. And anytime we start doing that, that's a slippery slope and we'll go down a road we don't want to go. I mean, this is why Paul, earlier in Romans 9, he says this, I have great sorrow and unceasing anguish in my heart for my fellow Jewish friends who do not know Christ. And he said, I would rather be accursed myself, and they go free. And he says, unceasing anguish, sorrow. Well, why, Paul? According to what this other pastor said, Paul, you don't have to be that sorry. It's not that big of a deal. It's really okay. And he doesn't. He knows. He knows what it is. Trying to soften the reality of hell is diminishing the complete work of Christ on the cross. It diminishes the work of Christ. If it isn't that bad, then Jesus made a mistake by being tormented and going to the cross. But he went, took on the full punishment. Which is why he cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Allow me to just share some thoughts on this, because I've batted this around for years and more intensely this week, just to gain some perspective. You know, if you go to the northwest corner of Wyoming and the southwest corner of Montana, there's an incredible national park called Yellowstone Park. And if you haven't been there, you should go sometime. It's an incredible place. High plains, beauty, great for family. But there are these sulfur ponds, if you will. and they're beautiful. But they are 190 degrees. They have the acidity of car battery acid. And what makes them so beautiful is in that acidity and in that heat, the bacteria grows and it produces this beautiful display of color that you can go and you can look at. It's much better to look at than smell. Okay, it smells like rotten eggs. But it's incredibly beautiful. Now, I don't believe that anyone chooses hell any more than I would choose to jump into one of those sulfur pools. I really don't believe that. I don't believe some. Maybe out of ignorance, but they just don't know. But ignorance isn't innocence. Romans 1 tells us we all have suppressed the truth. What human nature does choose, human nature does choose to sin, and we're all guilty. We've all suppressed the truth in various ways, and whether it's our words or whether it's at speech level, mind level, heart level, action level. I mean, second, all the sin that we create in our life, all the things that we do are just secondary offenses to the primary offense. And what's the primary offense? It's exchanging the glory of God for something else. That's the primary offense. It's us saying, God, I don't want you. I would rather have this. That's at the core of every sin. So when I'm involved in sexual sin, it's saying, God, I would rather not have what you have for me, and I would rather do it my way. Greed. God, I'm not going to go with your provision. I'm going to go with what I want to do, and here's what I want, and so I'm going to run with this. So it's all at the core, all sin is exchanging the glory of God for something else. I want something else. I can't say it any better than what John Piper puts it. He says this: nobody leaves God, forsakes God, abandons God, suppresses God, turns away from God simply because they value him little. We always turn away from God because we value something else more, which is why it is such a cosmic insult, an infinite outrage. This is the infinite outrage in the universe that human beings prefer something else to God. And I think the only thing in our life that kind of scratches the surface, if you will, a little bit, is when we experience betrayal in a relationship. When we have chosen to love someone and there is betrayal in that, and not just betrayal, that can be overcome, but I'm talking ongoing betrayal, an ongoing betrayal, and someone saying, I don't choose you, I do not love you anymore, I choose this, and I choose this, and I continue to choose this, and I continue to choose this. And as we continue to see that in a life that's just like, it's just rejection, 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 I'm choosing something different. I'm choosing to love somebody else. And so when we have a holy God who has not only given us physical life, but has sent his son to die a death that we deserve to die. And we say, no, I don't want you. I want to love these other things instead. Whatever it is, that's cosmic betrayal. That is sin at its epic proportions. Another way I think that we can look at this is some of the descriptions of hell when it comes to saying like eternal flame and all these things. I don't know if that is symbolic or not. It doesn't really matter because it's what it is it's trying to get to us that it is worse than you could ever imagine. Now, there is probably, I mean, there's a lot of things that could be bad, but I think burning alive is one of them. I can't think of much more that would be worse than that. I try not to put my mind to it too much, but that's bad. Wouldn't you agree? Now, when you have if you have kids or grandkids, and you say a three-year-old, and they take a fork and they're going to the outlet and they're going to stick the fork inside that outlet, what do you tell them? Don't do that. Why? You're going to get burned. Well, now actually, that's not what happens. You know, it's an electrical current will come into you. You're going to get zapped, you know, and it's going to hurt, and you're not going to like that. But we go to the one thing that we know nobody likes intuitively, burning. You're going to get burned. You know, and that is the way I think that we're, regardless of what it is, regardless of what this is going to be for eternity, we know it is worse than we could ever dare imagine. And it may or not be the point, but the fact is, you don't want this when this is available. He says, I'm giving you a choice. Infinite love, everything that you were created to be, is found in me. Or you can go your own way and go, the heck with that. I'm going with this. I want my way. You know, and I've had friends, I mean, particularly in college where I'd hear it, and I go, well, man, if I'm going to be, because most people, when you talk about hell, you get a fire and brimstone kind of a thing. And you know me long enough, I'm not a fire and brimstone kind of guy. I'm kind of a come let us reason together. And let's just talk about this and let's kind of reason through this. You know, but I've had friends and at different times. And so, well, a lot of times, anybody that's talking about hell does so in a way that's going, get over here, get right, do this, or you're all going to hell. You know, and I've had friends, you know, who are just like in college who are like, oh man, if that's the way it is, I'm just going to party with my friends forever. And I'm like, you have no idea. You have no idea. That's not what it's going to be at all. So my question, you know, when we talk about this is what makes hell so hellish? And really, you only need one. I'll give you two, but the one is the first. The first one really is the one that makes it the worst, and that is God's presence is removed, completely removed. I mean, think about it. What makes up our existence right now, whether you're a believer or you're not a believer, what holds all things together is God's presence. It's His Spirit. It's His favor. It's His grace that even allows those who hate Him and rather run from Him to still experience the beauty of that which He's created for them in hopes that they will come to know Him. And so everything that He's done, all of that is just, it is, you know, He's done all of that. He holds all things together. The air that we breathe, the bodies that we have to do the things that we're capable of, the sights we're able to see, the food we're able to taste, the generation after generation of little ones running around are all blessings from Him. All of that can be taken for granted, but you remove His presence, and I'm telling you, it is utter darkness and it's chaos. You remove His presence, and it's game over. Calamity of which I can't even comprehend. That alone would be enough. I think the other thing is just unbridled humanity. It is just flesh gone wild. I mean, we look at the book of Judges, and remember what it says repeatedly in the book of Judges is they did what was right in their own eyes. They did what was right in their own eyes. But it was still held back because God's presence was still there. But if everybody just did what was right in their own eyes and there was no presence of God there, I can't even imagine what man is capable of doing. And just humanity gone wild. I don't know anybody that would want that. And I don't believe there's anybody who's there from Scripture who goes, I like it here, I'll stay here. Even in Lazarus, when Abraham's bosom, and he calls back and he goes, tell everyone, I'm in flames here. Tell them, warn them about what's to come. And so I don't think there's anybody there. No, I don't think anybody chooses to go there, but I don't think anybody that is there is going, whoo, I'm glad I'm here. Made the right choice. They're all going, I want out of here. I want out of here. It's tough. It is hard, but truth is hard, which makes what Christ has done so amazing that you and I would even have an option. to be able to go, I can have eternity with you. You know, let's take it home. Worship team, you can come up, and we're going to take communion together. Paul Tripp, who really wrote this book, Do You Believe, which is the basis of what really got me going on wanting to try to do this sermon series. I'll just end with a quote from him. He says, "The fact that we think eternal punishment is harsh and makes God less than fair demonstrates how far we've strayed from the biblical understanding of how evil is and how gloriously holy God is. Perhaps the biblical description of the torment of hell is one of the only accurate mechanisms we have been given to weigh the magnitude of the sinfulness of sin." There's a lot there. Jesus' journey to the cross, folks, was intentional. He literally came to save us from what we deserved: hell. Eternity without him. So what do? Make it your life mission to treasure him above all else, because it is there your heart will find its truest delight, in him. Now, I think the bottom line is this morning is if you are living on this side of the sun and you approach and you think about this throne that's going to be coming, that we're all going to come to, if you can't have 100% certainty that you know that you'll be with him, then we would love to talk with you, because that's first and foremost. For those of you who do, and you're living under the sun, make it your goal to increase Christ as your treasure, that you would love him more and make it that your aim. And one of the ways this changes us is it changes us in the sense that we all know those who don't know Christ. And we need to get a bit more bolder in our proclamation to them, because the stakes are too high. Now look, I don't lead with a conversation on hell. I let that come as I get into the conversation with them. But first and foremost, I just want to ask them, where are you with Jesus? Do you know him? And have you understood the great hope that he has? That is something that we as believers need to be more bold with, in grace and in reverence, not in a condemning way, but in a bold look. I want you to have what I have. But may we be more bold in that. You know what to do. Go love first. We love because he first loved us. Have a great week.